Chapter 20. Most of the houses were known to the police, but there was an unwritten law in connection with them. When a raid was due to take place, the owner was warned, but the names of the men who had been imprisoned on the premises must be discoverable in some easily accessible desk drawer. During the next few days, a checkup would be made of passenger lists recording the names of indigents and criminals being sent to Mars, Venus, and the various moons. Government contractors were insatiably in need of men for work on other planets, and the houses, frequented as they were by wealthy women who could not afford scandals, supplied a constant trickle of labor with no questions asked. In their dealings with the houses, the police objected only to the idea that dead men tell no tales. Proprietors found themselves mercilessly haled into court when they broke that one unalterable rule. After thousands of years, it had proved an effective method of keeping vice operating within the important limit that the victim survived his grim experience. Cale stepped off the gangplank onto the soil of Mars and stopped. It was an involuntary reaction. The ground was as hard as rock. The chill of it penetrated the soles of his shoes and somehow pierced the marrow of his being. With ice-cold eyes, he surveyed the bleak town of Shardle. And this time a thought came, a hatred so violent that he shuddered, a determination so strong that he could feel the ice within him turning to steel. "Get a move on you." A stick prodded his shoulders. One of the soldiers directing the disembarkation of the long line of sullen men bawled the words, his voice sounding strangely hollow in that rarefied air. Cale did not even turn around. He moved. That was his reaction to the insult and indignity. He walked along, keeping his place in the line, and with every step he took, the chill off the ground penetrated more deeply into his lungs. Ahead of him, other men felt the constriction. They began to run. Still others broke past him, breathing hoarsely, the whites of their eyes showing, their bodies clumsily responding to the lesser gravity. The ground was rough and uneven, and those who fell cried out as the jagged edges tore at them. Human blood stained the iron-hard soil of ever-frozen Mars. Cale walked on, unheeding, contemptuous of those who had lost their heads. They had been warned against the gravity, and the great enclosed plastic compound was only a quarter of a mile away, the intervening cold shocking but bearable. He reached the compound, his flesh tingling, his feet numbed. It was warm inside, and he made his way slowly to the side of the building from which the main section of the town was visible. Shardle was a mining town. It stood on a flat plain that was just beginning to blossom here and there with the green of warm atomic gardens. The shrubbery, spotty and incongruous, only emphasized the near desolation of every visible horizon. He saw that men were studying bulletin boards over against one wall. He moved closer and read what he could see of one sign. It read, "Opportunity." Cale pressed up to it and read the rest of the words, then smiled and turned away. So they wanted people to sign up for Martian farms. "Agree to remain 15 years, and Her Gracious Majesty, Inelda of Isher, will supply you with a completely equipped atomic heated farm. No down payment, 40 years to pay." The offer concluded insinuatingly, "Go immediately to the lands office, sign your application, and you will not have to do 1 minute's work in the mines." Cale was immune to the appeal. He had heard of this system of colonizing the cold planet of Mars and the hot planet of Venus. Eventually, every acre of soil would be occupied and the planet subjected to the beneficent influence of atomic power. And so, over the millennia, men would at last thaw all the icy habitable worlds of the solar system and chill the burning deserts of Venus and Mercury. Men working out their lives on the drabber spawnings of their sun would create reasonable facsimiles of the far green earth from which they had come. That was the theory. In all those lazy days at public school, when he had read and listened to the accounts of colonization, he had not dreamed that he would one day be standing here, looking out at the half-light world of Mars, standing here, caught by a process too ruthless for any man, raised as he had been raised to resist. He had no hatred now of his father. That was gone out of him into the hazy mists of the past, into that world of nothingness where his illusions had gone. The poor, dumb fool. That was his thought now. Perhaps it was just as well some people never did comprehend the realities of life in the Empire of Isher. His own personal problem was solved in a simple, effective manner. He had been afraid. Now he wasn't. He had, astonishingly enough, been honest. Now he wasn't. Well, in a way, he wasn't. It all depended on an individual's outlook on life as to how far he'd accept the theory that a human being must be strong enough to face the necessities of his era. Cale Clark intended to face them all the way. Not for long would such a man as he had become remain on Mars. Meanwhile, he must sign nothing that would restrict his movements. He must be cautious, but seize opportunities instantly on an all-out basis. Behind him, a voice said slyly, "Am I addressing Cale Clark, formerly of the village of Glay?" Cale turned slowly. He hadn't expected opportunity to come so quickly. The man who stood before him was small. He wore an overcoat of expensive material, and he was very obviously not a person who had come on the boat, in spite of his shriveled and insignificant appearance. He spoke again. "I am the local representative of the Fifth Bank. It may be that we can help you out of this unusual situation." He looked like a toad, his gaunt face enframed in a high collar. His eyes, like black seeds, peered forth with a dull but avaricious light. Cale shrank involuntarily, not from fear, but from loathing. There had been a woman who came to the house, a woman bedecked with jewels and furs, with a face like that and eyes like that, and all the whips they had used on his bare back while she looked on with greedy eyes had not broken his will to have nothing to do with her. It cost Cale an effort of mind to realize that he must not necessarily compare the two people or believe that they had anything in common. "Interested?" asked the creature. Cale started to nod, and then a word that hadn't really penetrated before came through to his consciousness. "What bank did you say?" The human caricature smiled with the look of a man who realized he was bearing precious gifts. "The Fifth Bank," he said. "You made a deposit in our central at Imperial City about a month ago. In the course of a normal investigation of the background of any new depositor, we discovered that you were on your way to Mars under unpleasant circumstances. We therefore wish to place our loan department at your service." "I see," said Cale carefully. His eyes, sharp and alert, made another more detailed examination of this agent of the great bank. But there was nothing new, nothing to inspire confidence. And yet he did not think of ending the conversation. "Just what would the bank do for me?" he asked quietly. The man cleared his throat. "You are the son of Farah and Creel Clark?" he asked pompously. Cale admitted the relationship after a moment's hesitation. "You desire to return to Earth?" There was no hesitation about his answer to that. "Yes," he said. "The base fare," said the man, "is 600 credits for the trip when the distance between Mars and Earth permits a 24-day journey. When the distance is greater, the cost is 10 credits a day extra. You probably knew that." Cale hadn't known. But he had guessed that the mine head wage of 25 credits a week would not provide a quick means of returning to Earth. He felt tensed, conscious of how completely a man without resources could be confined to a planet. He had an idea of what was coming. "The Fifth Bank," said the man in a grand tone, "will loan you the sum of 1,000 credits if your father will guarantee the debt, and if you will sign a note agreeing to pay back 10,000 credits. Cale sat down heavily. The end of hope had come more swiftly than he had expected. "My father," he said wearily, "would never guarantee a note for 10,000 credits." "Your father," said the agent, "will be asked to guarantee only the 1,000. You will be expected to pay 10,000 out of your future earnings." Cale studied him with narrowed eyes. "By what method will this money be paid over to me?" The gaunt face smiled. "You sign, and we give it to you. And just leave your father to us. The bank has a psychology department for handling co-signers and signers of notes. On some, we use the dominating technique. On others..." Cale interrupted. "So far as I am concerned, the money has to be paid over to me before I sign." The other shrugged and laughed. "As you will. I see you are a sharp dealer. Come over to the mine manager's office." He walked off, Cale following thoughtfully. It was too easy, and he didn't like it. Everything was happening too swiftly, as if this were part of the routine of the end of a voyage. He slowed and looked around alertly. There was a long line of offices, he saw, where other men were being taken by well-dressed individuals. It seemed to him that he could visualize the picture then. The first offer on the bulletin board. Volunteer to go on a farm. If they didn't get you that way, then along came a smooth-tongued man to offer a loan on the basis of your family credit. The loan money would either not be advanced at all, or it would be stolen from you almost immediately afterwards. Thereupon, having exhausted all your available resources, present and future, you were on Mars to stay. There'll be a couple of witnesses, Clark thought. Big fellows with guns on them to make sure that you don't get your money. It was a good way to colonize an unfriendly planet, possibly the only way, considering that human beings were not too interested anymore in pioneering. He walked into the office, and there were the two men, well-dressed, smiling, friendly. They were introduced as respectively the mine manager and a clerk from the bank. Clark wondered cynically how many other persons, shanghaied as he had been, were being introduced at this moment to the mine manager. It sounded very impressive, and it must be thrilling to have a chance to talk in heart-to-heart fashion with so important a personage, to realize that he was human after all. Cale shook hands with him and then turned to look the situation over. The important thing was to get the money legally. That meant actually signing the document and getting a copy. Even that might not mean anything, but after all, there was a certain amount of law on the planets. The dangerous thing was to be without money and to arrive in court where other men could blandly deny one's story. The room was not large, but it was luxuriously furnished. It could have been a mine manager's office. There were two doors, the one through which he had come, and one directly opposite, where presumably the robbed individual made his exit without getting any chance to talk to people in the big room from which he had come. Clark walked over to the second door, opened it, and saw that it led outside. There were scores of huts within sight, and standing in groups all around were soldiers. The sight of them gave him pause, for obviously they would make it impossible for him to make a run for it if he succeeded in obtaining the money. He used his body to block off the mob. With swift fingers, he tested to see if it were locked from the outside. It was. Quietly, he closed the door, and with a smile, turned back into the room. He shivered convincingly. Sure chilly out there. I'll be glad to get back to Earth. The three men smiled sympathetically, and the reptilian bank agent held out a document with 10 100-credit notes clipped to it. Clark counted the money and put it in his pocket. Then he read the contract. It was quite simple, apparently designed to ease the minds of people who were suspicious of involved forms. There were three copies, one to be sent to Earth, one for the Martian branch, and one for him. They were properly signed and sealed and awaited only his signature. Clark tore off the bottom one and put it into his pocket. The others were inserted into the registered circuit. He signed the first one with a flourish, and then he stepped back and threw the pen, point first, into the face of the manager. The man screamed and put his hand up to his torn cheek. That was all Clark saw. With a jump, he reached the side of the toad-like man, grabbed at his neck just above the heavy coat collar, and squeezed with all his strength. The creature yelped and struggled weakly. For a moment, then, Clark had the sharp fear that his plan for attack had been falsely based. He had assumed that the other had a gun also, and would reach for it in panic. Long, skinny fingers were clawing inside the voluminous coat. They came out clutching a little glittering blaster that Clark snatched, hand and all, and crushed into his own palm. Simultaneously, he squeezed the weapon away from the other's grasp. He saw that the big clerk had his gun out and was edging around, trying to get a chance to use it without harming the reptile. Clark took a snapshot at the man's foot. The radiant flame made a thin, bright beam. There was an odor of burning leather and a streamer of blue smoke. With the cry, the fellow dropped his weapon and sat down heavily on the floor. He writhed there, clutching at his foot. At Clark's urging, the manager held up his hands reluctantly. Swiftly, Clark relieved him of his blaster, picked up the one on the floor, and back toward the door. He explained his plan briefly. The toad would accompany him as a hostage. They would go to the nearest airline base and fly to the city of Mare Cimmerium, at which point he would catch a regular liner from Earth. And if anything should go wrong, Cale Clark concluded, at least one person will die before I do. Nothing went wrong. And that day was August 26th, 4784 Isher, 2 months and 23 days after Imperial Inelda launched her attack on the weapon makers.